This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Bob Boyle joins us to talk about a recent lawsuit Mumia Abu-Jamal brought against the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections.
Mumia is suffering from a life-threatening liver illness, but Bob Boyle got a very favorable reaction from the federal judge in Pennsylvania.
Aliyah Hussein from the Center for Constitutional Rights joins us to give us an update on the remaining inmates at Guantanamo Bay Prison.
She's been to Guantanamo. She was in Washington, D.C. last week to protest the existence of Guantanamo now for 14 years, and she'll tell us what it's like to be there and what we can do to get those people out.
We'll talk about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Is it environmental racism?
It sure is, and it's also an example of lack of democracy because the appointed head of the city of Flint, who replaced the mayor and who's not accountable to the population, thought he'd save money by feeding these children filthy water.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Smith, you know I have an aversion to electoral politics, and as such, I've only watched a total of about 10 minutes of all of the debates, be they Republican or Democratic. But you've been staying on top of this. So I wanted to start by asking you what you think of our Republican presidential candidates. I know you have some strong opinions.
Well, I admire your aversion. I think that's healthy self-protection. What does it come from? You're being an anarchist living on the Lower East Side in New York?
No, I'm just disillusioned with the candidates in general. I also don't like the way it takes over all of the media and popular culture way over a year before we need to know anything
election.
About it.
In other countries, you have an election that, from the beginning to end, lasts 12 days. That would make sense. But in this one, it's really a money contest. And you got to have a lot of money to last for 14 months. And we see them duking it out.
And I don't want to give more airtime, for example, to Donald Trump. But a friend of mine told me yesterday, Michael, that he thinks he has a really good chance. Do you agree with that? A lot of people are coming out and saying they like what he says. People, we would be surprised. I think the appeal of Trump is the appeal that some people enjoyed in Chris Christie. He's a marketing genius. He's not articulate. He says hateful things that prompt hate speech and hate actions, which is really damaging not only to individuals but to us as a society as a whole, makes us look insane in the eyes of countries around the globe. But a lot of people love him, Michael. We can't ignore that.
No, I think that Trump is a narcissistic, self-important, authoritarian bully. And I think that he appeals to other people who want an authoritarian figure to support. I think it's too early to tell whether he'll get the Republican nomination. I think there's a hardcore people out there that support him. There were hardcore people out there that watched his television program and enjoyed seeing him fire people. And I think these people are mostly losers. They identified with Trump when they should have been identifying with these people who got fired. It's an irony. The other guy who's just as distasteful personally is Cruz.
Agree.
Who reminds me of Nixon. He's pretty crafty. The guy went to Princeton and Harvard. Mm. He's smart. He's nasty.
Yeah.
And he's unlikable. And people don't like him. I mean,
mean-spirited.
Politicians don't like him. Very, very nasty guy.
We New Yorkers, of course, don't like him for his disparaging remarks.
It's going nowhere here. Yeah. And it's kind of neck and neck in Iowa, so we'll see what happens with those two guys. The rest of them are kind of marginal figures. As to the Democrats, I mean, what do you think?
Well, I know you don't care for Hillary. You've made that abundantly clear over the last few years.
I would make a broader statement than that. Political parties represent classes. In the United States, the bosses have two political parties, and we don't have any. You've got two capitalist class parties, the Republican on the far right and the Democratic Party, which is kind of center right. And that's how I would classify Hillary. I don't support the Democratic Party. I did at one time. I made the mistake in 1964, the first time I voted, and I was around SDS. And SDS's slogan was part of the way with LBJ.
Right,
and
I remember that.
I knew better. I knew better. But LBJ was saying, I won't go into Vietnam. And he was running against Goldwater, who wanted to escalate the war in Vietnam. So I held my nose and I voted for LBJ. And what happened? He escalated the war in Vietnam. That was the last time I voted for a Democrat because I understood the nature of the Democratic Party, and more broadly, that this system prevents people like us, Heidi, from having our own party.
Right.
It's nearly impossible. If we had a parliamentary system, it would be another thing. But the ruling rich have rigged it, so they've got two parties and we have none.
But I know you were happy when Bernie came out with a socialist platform.
I have mixed feelings about it. When Francis Golden and Debbie Smith and I did that book a year and a half ago, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. I have friends who are social friends with Bernie. So I got his address and I sent him a copy of the book.
Nice.
And he wrote me back the nicest note, a handwritten note, and he used his own stamp. And he thanked me for the book and so on. And I wrote him back and I said, well, I appreciate that you appreciate the book. And if you run as a socialist for president, I'll do everything I can to help you. But he instead made a deal with the devil, ran as a Democrat, told the Democratic National Committee that in turn for their allowing him to be part of the debates, you know, because they run the debates.
Right.
Hillary really runs the debates. He said, you let me into the debates, and if I lose, then I'll support whoever wins. That is, I'll support Hillary. Mm-hmm. So part of me says it's great that he's making the term socialism no longer a dirty word. I think that's great. And I like a lot of the things he stands for, universal health care, free college tuition. This country could certainly afford it if they didn't spend half of the gross national product on military. They could certainly afford these things like other industrialized countries do. But on the other hand, he's going to take all these people, and the reason for his success, he's mobilized all these hundreds of thousands of young people, and he's going to take them right back into the Democratic Party, which has been historically the graveyard of all social movements. So he's a mixed blessing, but we're in a mixed period. I think that the idea we shouldn't have billionaires running the country, which is what he's popularizing, is going to become more and more acceptable. On the other hand, we've got to explain to people that social change comes from below. It comes from what we do ourselves, and that we're never going to take over the Democratic Party because it's not our institution.
Okay, Michael, bottom line, your prediction. Who's going to be our next president?
This is a tough one. I don't know that Hillary can get elected because she's really not very likable.
What about all the women in the country who want to see a female president?
Well, I think there are a lot of people like that, but I don't think there are enough. I don't know whether she'll get the nomination. I suppose she will get the nomination because I don't think the Democratic
all
Party
right,
establishment is going to let
Trump or Hillary
Sanders to do it. Look, Hillary is a real war hawk. She helped overthrow the president of Honduras a couple years ago. She green-lighted the war against Libya that overthrew the head of that country. She said, we came, we saw, he died. And she had a smile on her face when she said, it's really cruel.
Michael, that's awful.
She's the candidate of the bankers. She gets a lot of money from Goldman Sachs. They gave her $600,000, as Bernie pointed
out,
for one speech.
Okay, your prediction. We only have a minute left.
My prediction?
Our next president.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Cruz.
Oh, no. For 3 days in late December, the Third Circuit Federal District Court heard Mumia Abu-Jamal's lawsuit against the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections for refusal to provide him treatment for hepatitis C. Testimony from Dr. Paul Noel, Chief Medical Officer of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, revealed that under their new protocols, only 5 out of an estimated 5,000 prisoners with chronic hep C were being treated with the new antiviral drug beginning this fall. That's less than 0.1%. Joining us to tell us about what happened is Bob Boyle, Mumia's attorney who went to Scranton to litigate this case. Bob is a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild here in New York City. Bob Boyle, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi, and hello, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Bob. Good.
Bob, you and Brett Grody just finished a 3-day trial in which Mumia Abu-Jamal's lack of hepatitis C treatment was at issue. Tell us briefly how the case got to court, and paint, if you will, sort of a summary of the 3 days.
Sure. Well, Mumia's health had been deteriorating for, I guess, the last 16 months or so, and inexplicably, with an unexplained skin rash, anemia, and certain other problems that occurred. He had been tested positive for the antibody that causes hepatitis C about 5 years ago, but there was never any follow-up work done. And as we proceeded along, we were trying informally to get help from the Department of Corrections to address his myriad of issues, which included 2 hospitalizations, and we were unsuccessful. So in the summer, a lawsuit was filed, summer of 2014, a lawsuit was filed demanding adequate health care. In the interim, he did receive from some blood work, which in fact confirmed that he has an active hepatitis C infection. In other words, he has chronic hepatitis C. He has a viral load. And all of our experts, and actually it was a no-brainer for anyone who looks into it, came to the conclusion that his myriad of symptoms were likely the result of hepatitis C. Now, as many of your listeners know, because it's been in the news, particularly in the past few months, there's this new so-called wonder drug that, if taken according to prescription, can cure hepatitis C. It has a 95% cure rate if taken, and I think the treatment runs approximately 10 to 12 weeks, which is much better than the other medications prior to it, which had a very low success rate and had enormous side effects. But the Pennsylvania Department of Correction does not treat anyone with this new drug. I think it came out at our hearing, at a minimum 7,000 inmates in Pennsylvania with chronic hepatitis C, they're treating 5.
Hepatitis C is a very serious illness.
It's a very serious illness. You can be asymptomatic for 30 years or so. Upwards of 30% of the cases, it can progress to cirrhosis over 20 years. And of those, approximately 5 to 7% per year, not 5 to 7%, but 5 to 7% per year, advance to liver cancer. And many just don't survive. I mean, cirrhosis can cause liver failure. Hepatitis C is the number one cause of liver transplants in the United States now. It's also the number one cause of liver cancer in the United States. It's a potentially fatal disease, but even short of being fatal, it seriously affects quality of life in terms of producing fatigue, pain, and a myriad of other health issues. So the department refused to give Mumia, as they have everyone else, virtually this new drug. So we filed a motion for a preliminary injunction back in August or early September, demanding that they give him this drug. And finally, after it weaved its way from the magistrate who denied or recommended denial of the motion, we got before the United States District Court Judge Robert D. Mariani in the Middle District of Pennsylvania, who scheduled hearings, we thought might last only a day, but dragged on for almost a week. And I don't say dragged on, it was actually, you know, quite revelatory what came out of these hearings in Scranton, Pennsylvania, in terms of both the treatment of Mumia and the treatment of everyone in Pennsylvania. And I would suspect most departments of corrections around the country in terms of treatment for hepatitis C.
Bob, I understand that Mumia testified by Skype. How did he appear?
Well, right now, Mumia looks better than he has in the past several months. That, according to his blood work, is the same. He still has anemia. He has a low platelet level and so forth. But the skin condition has improved somewhat. So he looked better than some of the photographs that have appeared on the net over the past several months. But according to all of our experts, and according to even the Department of Corrections experts, particularly the skin condition will wax and wane. You have flares, you get better, and you have a flare again. But if you don't treat the underlying condition, which is the hepatitis C, it's going to come back again, or something else will come back again. You know, the anemia was a particular concern for us because not to get too technical, but his hemoglobin levels were very, very low. They're still abnormal. The platelets are still abnormal. And one very sobering fact that came out at the hearing was that according to blood work, there's a 63% chance that he has cirrhosis right now. Not a 63% chance that he'll get cirrhosis, but a 63% chance that he has it right now. And even in the face of that, this is one of the amazing things that came out at the hearing, even in the face of that, and this came from their medical experts who didn't agree with it, they still recommend that he not be treated.
Right.
With the drug.
Now, Bob, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm oversimplifying, but it really boils down to the Department of Corrections alleging that, as you've just suggested, Mumia is not ill enough for the treatment. He probably literally has to be on death's door before they would give it to him. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. And actually, one of the things that came out at the hearing was that we forced the Department of Correction to publicly disclose their alleged hepatitis C health protocol. In other words, he's written guidelines for the treatment of hepatitis C, something that they've been keeping secret.
And didn't they want you to sign a confidentiality agreement related to that?
Yes, they did. But as soon as it came out that it existed, first they demanded a confidentiality agreement, and then the following day they said it isn't necessary because it was all over YouTube and everywhere else. So it was, and Facebook and all of that. So they didn't, you know, it would have been a moot point. But their protocol, essentially, and once again, not to be too technical, someone has to have portal hypertension to be treated under their protocol. And that is an advanced stage of cirrhosis. That's when the liver is so calcified that blood can't get into it and other vessels start bursting. And it is, you're almost at death's door at that point. It's quite an amazing document. You know, they said that these are the people we're going to treat right now. And when we asked them, well, are there plans to treat anyone else? They flat out said no. They said, oh, well, you know, we'll get to them. But in the meantime, you know, people's health are deteriorating. Mumia's is deteriorating, and 6,000 other people, their health is deteriorating.
Bob, I want to ask you the implications. Assuming that you win on your motion and force the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to give Mumia the drugs that will help him, what are the implications for other prisoners in Pennsylvania?
Well, it should be, at a minimum, a positive precedent for them. But we did very well at this hearing. However, there's always a caution when you're dealing with the federal court and the issue of prisons, because the standard, as you know, that you have to prove to get a federal court to intervene in a state prison issue is a standard under the Eighth Amendment, which is deliberate indifference to health care. And the courts have set a very high standard for that. Basically, it has to amount to no treatment at all. And it's a very difficult standard. I think we more than met it in this case, but it's an extremely difficult standard to make because they came in like they did in the 3 days in Scranton. Well, he's in the infirmary. He's getting regular blood work. We're giving him steroid creams for his skin. We're giving him this ultraviolet light treatment for his skin. You know, we're keeping an eye on his liver functions, et cetera, et cetera. And they're saying that's all the Constitution requires. Now, there is also a class action case brought by some other National Lawyers Guild attorneys, which is pending in Philadelphia, which is seeking statewide treatment in the state of Pennsylvania to everyone with hepatitis C. So really, there's two legal proceedings which can affect the positive change. There's also, from what I understand, many of the state legislators are extremely upset with the Department of Correction for not dealing with this issue, and so there's political pressure as well. And we're hoping to win the injunction, but the real issue is getting him this treatment, whether it happens through an injunction, through a rule change, or legislative action. We just think that everyone should get the treatment.
Barbara, we talk about money here. Is the state of Pennsylvania subcontracting out the health care for these prisoners to some private corporation that doesn't want to spend the money? Is that the problem?
That is part of the problem, and that's true in most states now. Health care is farmed out. In Pennsylvania, it's this outfit called Correct Care Solutions. Hmm. And they are a private, for-profit company. From what I understand, it wouldn't hurt their bottom line so much because they're guaranteed under their contract a certain level of profit. So the treatment for the hepatitis C would be supplemented out of the state's budget. But certainly that plays into it. And one of the issues here is, of course, the treatment costs $84,000. It's $1,000 a pill.
Whoa.
For everyone. So multiply 7,000 people times $84,000. Now, I'm not defending the Department of Correction by any means, but I think we can agree that that's obscene, that drug companies are charging that amount of money for this life-saving drug. I think in places like India, Egypt, I think it's $100 a pill. In India, it's something like $10 a pill. But because of our patent laws in this country, it's only available for $1,000 a pill. It is obscene.
Scandalous.
That they are charging that. But there was one of the many interesting tidbits in the hearing was I was cross-examining their so-called expert on hepatitis C, a man by the name of Cowan, Jay Cowan, who was head of Horizon Medical, which handled the treatment, which up until till tomorrow is head of Rikers Island Medical Treatment. And they were forced out due to a scandal there. But in any event, I asked him, one of my last questions to him was, Dr. Cowan, if someone walked into your office and had good insurance and they had the same symptoms as Mr. Abu Jamal, would you recommend treatment with the new drug? And he said, yes, I would recommend treatment with the new drug. So the issue is not a medical one. The issue is a fiscal one because they cannot medically justify failure to treat. And under the Eighth Amendment, if someone requires treatment, cost is not supposed to be an issue. But, of course, it's the, not too invisible elephant in the room here. And clearly there's going to have to be policy changes around this country through Medicaid and, provisions for prisoners that enables people to be treated.
When do you expect a decision on this?
Well, we expect the judge wants post-hearing briefs, which will be due towards the end of January. He stated, and we can't ask for anything better, he said this case is the number one priority on his docket. So I would assume, within a month after we file briefs, he should issue a decision. But let's hope the state of Pennsylvania wakes up and just starts providing treatment.
Let's all hope, yeah.
Without a court order.
Thank you so much for all
Thank
your
you so much.
Hard
and yes,
work.
I'd be happy to give further updates. Just let me know.
Okay.
Well, we expect to have you back, Bob, and we're going to put the contact sites on our website at lawanddisorder.org so people can follow this on the web.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Bye.
As of January 2016, more than 100 men remain at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. While our own Michael Ratner was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a network of hundreds of lawyers was put together to do legal battle against the indefinite detention and torture at Guantanamo. The center won landmark Supreme Court cases that established U.S. court jurisdiction over the prison and affirming detainee rights to habeas corpus review. Hundreds of Muslim men and boys have gradually been released from the offshore prison. The majority of the men at the prison weren't charged with any crime. Many have been cleared for release, yet remain trapped in the political prison by Obama's inaction. The pressure from concerned activist groups, organizations, and citizens calling on the President of the United States to close Guantanamo has gained momentum. To talk more about recent actions, we're joined by Aliyah Hussein, the head of the advocacy program for the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Aliyah, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Aliyah, as part of your job at the Center for Constitutional Rights, you've been down to Guantanamo. What was it like?
The Center for Constitutional Rights has been leading the fight to close Guantanamo since it opened. And so CCR lawyers and legal workers have been visiting the base for over a decade. So I made my first visit in 2012, when I was just 27 years old. And it was striking to see that the men that I was meeting with were my age, just a few years older. The majority of the men that I have been meeting with for the last few years have been cleared for release years ago, some since 2007, some since 2009. There are many things that are striking about the experience there, but I think my biggest takeaway was really the human cost of indefinite detention. One of our clients, Fahad Ghazi, was just 17 when he arrived at Guantanamo and is my age. And so as I told him a little bit about myself, where I went to school, sort of the career path I had chosen, I realized that everything I was describing had happened during the time that he had been detained, when he was not able to see his family, see his young daughter, and really live the life that he was meant to live.
Are these contact visits, or are you separated by plexiglass or partition?
We're able to sit around a table much like the one we're sitting around right now. So we sit across from a table. Until recently, we were allowed to bring in food, coffee, drinks, and to share a meal with our clients, pass notes, really have an open discussion for about two and a half hours.
Well, one of your clients is Tariq Baodeh. When last you saw him, what was it like and how's he doing?
So I last saw Tariq in March 2015. Tariq's been detained since 2002, cleared for release since 2009, and he's actually been in a long-term hunger strike since 2007. That means that he's been force-fed every day since 2007. For 8 years. Next month in February, it'll be nine.
Is that intubation, or how does force-feeding occur?
So he's force-fed through his nose. It's, it's very gruesome. And for Tariq, this is the only way he has to really reflect back what Guantanamo has done to him and others. It's a peaceful protest, really to show his resistance to over a decade of indefinite detention. So when I saw him last March, he's always been a slight man, but it was clear that his physical situation had deteriorated so significantly. We later found out by the government's own reports that he weighs only 74 pounds, which is about 56% of his ideal body weight. So since then, CCR actually filed a motion in federal court asking for a judge to help facilitate his immediate release on medical grounds.
Doesn't that arise to torture, the force feeding?
Yes. There are international law. There are many human rights experts who've come out and said that force feeding is torture. Tariq himself has really described this as torture as well. It's not only the fact that he's force fed, but the manner in which he's force fed. He's often pulled out of his cell, strapped to a restraint chair, and force fed. So everything around it is quite cruel. And because of Tariq's peaceful protest, he lives in Guantanamo's Camp 5, which means that he's in near solitary confinement with little to no contact with other prisoners, and has been for years.
And what is holding up his release?
So what's holding up his release, I think, is really what's holding up the release of so many men, which is a lack of political will on the president's part. Tariq is cleared for release. The government said years ago that he is approved to be transferred, yet he remains. So really, it's a lack of political will on the president's part to get his administration in line, to expedite the transfers of him.
Are you saying that Obama, with the stroke of a pen, could get him out of there?
There are many ways that Obama could get Tariq and others like him out of there. One example is recent media reports have shown that the Department of Defense has derailed and obstructed closure efforts through bureaucratic inaction. Obama, as the commander-in-chief, can ensure that his administration, including all of the agencies in it, really work towards his goal. Obama has the power to urge the Department of Justice to stop opposing habeas petitions, like Tariq's petition. When we filed this motion over the summer, the government asked for 3 extensions to decide whether or not it would oppose his motion. They ultimately decided to oppose the motion. And to be clear, they agreed he's cleared for release and we're working on his transfer. But in federal court, they opposed his motion, signaling really that they care more about their preserving their legal authority to detain men like Tariq rather than release him.
You were in Washington, D.C. last week for the 14th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo. What was it like down there? What were the demands?
So CCR joined a number of other groups that have been outside the White House every year since President Obama has come into office. That includes groups like Witness Against Torture, Amnesty International, CARE, the National Religious Coalition Against Torture. So it's a really great group of committed activists who stand outside the White House and really demand that President Obama fulfill his promise, and especially with this last year of his presidency, to show leadership and put his full weight and authority into closing the prison. And what was really remarkable, too, about this anniversary is that protests were going on throughout the globe, including in the UK. Shakir Ahmed, who was released just a few years ago, rallied a group of former detainees to stand outside the U.S. Embassy in London. And it was a really great showing of former detainees coming to the embassy and demanding that the U.S. release the remaining brothers who remain. There's a beautiful Al Jazeera Plus video of Shakir and other men talking and their demands, and I think it does a great job of really demystifying the men who were detained in the first place, and then also to show a picture of those who are released and are living peacefully, who have families, who have continued their lives.
How many people are still there, and of those, how many have been cleared for release?
So currently, 103 men remain. 44 are cleared for release. And cleared for release means that every agency with a stake in national security has approved them to be transferred.
Does that mean, excuse me, that there's a country willing to accept them? Or does that have to be negotiated?
So that does not mean that there is a country yet lined up. So that does have to be negotiated. But also, many of these men have been cleared now for over 5 years. So to the extent that negotiations can and should have happened earlier, you know, these men could have been out. And there has been a recent spate of transfers, which, of course, are welcomed, but these men could have been released years ago, and so it's important to remember that.
So do you believe that they're being held today unlawfully?
Yes. The government would say the contrary, but we believe that this is arbitrary detention, that there is no reason to continue holding most of these men. The overwhelming majority have never been charged with a crime and never will be. And as I mentioned earlier, 44 men have been cleared for release. There's no reason to continue holding them, yet they remain.
So what is the Center for Constitutional Rights and its allies doing to pressure the government to do the right thing?
CCR and our allies are doing, I think, a little bit of everything in hopes that together they will work and really urge the president to transfer these men and close the prison. That includes litigating habeas cases in federal court, hoping to apply more pressure on the administration to not reflexively fight the cases of men like Tariq Bawuda who are cleared for release. Allies have launched a whitehouse.gov petition, which has, I think, a few tens of thousands of signatures already. This petition launched yesterday. That's also a great way to get the public to sign on and show their support for closing the prison. And it's also public education work. While that work is not necessarily targeted at the administration, it's so important that people are educated on this issue. Even in D.C., when I was carrying posters to the rally, a few people stopped me, asked what the rally was about, and said, I thought President Obama closed the prison. So there are still, I think, misconceptions by people who I think, ultimately would like for the prison to be closed, but they either just are not informed or, you know, Republican propaganda or just general misconceptions continue to dominate the narrative around Guantanamo.
Aliyah, I understand that you have a few quotes from your client, Tariq Bouda. Can you read that for us?
Yes, I would love to. Tariq, as I mentioned, is on hunger strike and writes very beautifully about what that protest means for him. So I'll go ahead and read that now. I believe that the darkness of the solitary cells and its extreme coldness turned off the flame of the Statue of Liberty. My body has become frail, weak, and sick because of the beating and the awful psychological and physical torture during these long years. But I feel that my spirit has gotten stronger than before. The body weakens in front of the difficult challenges that it faces, such as torture and provocations, but the soul strengthens against such difficult challenges that it may face for its principles. Freedom should be much more precious for the human being than all the desires on earth, and we should never give it up regardless of how expensive the price may be.
Mm. Beautiful.
Amazing.
How can our listeners contact you to support the effort of getting people like Tariq out of there?
The Center for Constitutional Rights, if you haven't visited our website, please do. It's a great way to learn about our clients and their stories, to also learn about what the current legal and political landscape is, and also to figure out a way to help and show solidarity that can include events that we have in New York City and elsewhere around the country, petitions, either targeted at the Department of Justice or the president, and also other ways to support this work, including writing to prisoners to show solidarity. And really just to, I think education is so important, and we all have friends and colleagues who don't know what's going on right now in Guantanamo, and I think talking to people and really spreading this message can be impactful.
What's the website for the center?
The website is ccrjustice.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at the CCR, and you can sign up for our emails, and that's a great way to hear about updates with respect to Guantanamo and so much of our other issues.
Well, Aliyah, you're really heroes in our eyes for keeping up this important fight for 14 years.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for allowing me to talk a bit about our clients and our work.
Thank you for being on Law & Disorder. Best of luck, and keep checking in with us so we can follow this.
Okay, thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
A severe water crisis in the city of Flint, Michigan is attracting mounting concern from all around the country. Politicians, celebrities, and even presidential candidates are focusing on the toxic tap water in one of Michigan's biggest and most troubled cities. When the state took charge of the city's budget during a financial emergency, it temporarily switched Flint's water source from Lake Huron to the long-polluted Flint River. After the April 2014 changeover, residents quickly complained about water looking, smelling, and tasting odd. Virginia Tech researchers revealed that the water was highly corrosive. A class action lawsuit now alleges that the State Department of Environmental Quality failed to treat the water for corrosion, as federal law requires. And because so many service lines to Flint are made of lead, the toxic element leached into the water of the city's homes. As listeners know, exposure to lead at certain levels can cause permanent brain damage in children. Although the city switched back to the Lake Huron water supply in October, the damage was already done to the lead pipes. The National Guard is now handing out filters and bottled water to residents. Joining us to talk about this unfolding crisis is Sheila Foster, the Albert A. Walsh Professor of Law at Fordham Law School and faculty co-director of the Urban Law Center at Fordham. Welcome, Sheila, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, we've all heard so much recently about the disaster in Flint, Michigan. Tell us in your own words, how did we get to this situation and what are the key points?
Sure. So from what I understand, the state decided to temporarily switch the water source from which Flint, Michigan, a city that's made of a majority of African-American residents and over 40% of the residents live below the poverty line, but to switch the water source away from Lake Huron to a local river, the Flint River, which had a reputation as being, you know, quite polluted. After the switch, Flint residents began to notice that their water looked funny, it smelled funny, the water was brown, and there were some acute health problems, you know, kids breaking out, and as well as some obvious signs that something was wrong with the water, some corrosion in home pipes, etc. And when some of the water was tested in homes in Flint, it was discovered that there were very high levels of lead in the water, leading to what is now, as we know, a public relations nightmare for the governor and for the state of Michigan.
Apart from the public relations nightmare, what's the health situation with the children? Can that lead be leached out of their bodies? Did it reach such an extent that it's going to cause brain damage? What do we know about that?
So I do know that some of the children who were exposed to the water have been diagnosed with lead poisoning. That lead, of course, has acute and chronic effects. I'm not a scientist, so I don't want to speak specifically. The state and federal agencies that regulate the environment know that exposure to lead is supposed to be kept to a very safe level. And the level that the kids were exposed to far exceeded those levels, suggesting that there may likely be long-term health problems, and certainly there are acute problems right now. And I believe that the state is in the process, or at least agents of the state, either departments of health or other experts, are in the process of assessing, I think, who's exposed and what the consequences of that exposure will be.
How many people are we talking about? How many children and how many people in the city of Flint?
The city of Flint is, I think, around 100,000 residents. I don't have exact numbers on that. And I think at least the number of children that were exposed is around 27,000. I'm not sure how many adults on top of the children were exposed. But lead in children in particular, I mean, that's a problematic link and has been for many decades. And so their bodies are still developing. And so exposure to lead and children are certainly more vulnerable to this. And in fact, historically, inner city children and children of color in particular have been overexposed. This is a real instance of what I would call environmental injustice or environmental racism, which is something that I write about.
Exactly, Sheila. I was going to ask, why does this qualify? Is it because of the demographics of Flint?
Yes, it's because of the demographics of Flint and because the data that we have had for many decades, and President Bill Clinton signed an executive order on environmental justice that highlighted this problem, but the data has shown that African Americans and other racial minorities, in particular Latinos, and those that are what we would call low income, live in neighborhoods, live in areas of the country in which they are overexposed to hazardous pollutants and other toxins. Lead being among one of them, and that exposure comes through a variety of sources. Traditionally, the studies that have pointed to instances or patterns of environmental injustice or the unfair distribution of environmental hazard exposure have focused on polluting facilities or waste dumps. But in this case and in other cases, the exposure doesn't come from a dump or a facility, but rather from a polluted water source. And the idea is that we tolerate unequal exposure of minorities, and in particular low-income racial minorities, to hazards or hazardous substances and a variety of toxins. And so this unequal distribution of exposure and the attendant health problems and other problems is what we refer to as environmental injustice or environmental racism. And again, President Clinton in 1994 signed an executive order which directed every federal agency to conduct its programs and to craft its policies in such a way so as not to result in the unequal or disproportionate burden on these communities from pollution and other hazard exposure. So this, in a sense, is a classic case of environmental injustice or environmental racism.
Add another layer of injustice on this, Sheila. Let's talk about austerity, because if it wasn't for the state of Michigan being in bad financial shape and trying to save money, this wouldn't have happened. And I wanted to ask you about that aspect of it.
Well, so I think it's more actually serious than that, the injustice, because as we know, many states and local governments have been in a state of austerity for now many years. And the question is that when we have to make trade-offs, right, in that kind of situation, are we going to sacrifice certain populations for the benefit of larger goals or other goals? And so part of the analysis of environmental injustice and environmental racism is this idea that there are certain sacrifice zones, right, in the country that, for instance, if we know we're, you know, consuming more than we can safely, you know, get rid of as waste, and we as a society are not paying the true cost of our consumption patterns, then what happens and what we see is that certain communities are then asked to bear a disproportionate burden of processing that waste, or at least being exposed to the processing of that waste or the disposal of that waste. In this kind of situation, one has to ask, were there other alternatives to the choice that the state had at this point, which I think the reason that they decided to temporarily switch was not just to save costs, but I think there was a new supply line being constructed in Lake Huron. And so so clearly they had to make some accommodation for both cost reasons and for other reasons. And why this choice, right? And even more so, for a long time, neither the governor nor the state agency in charge of environmental health did anything about it. That's another layer of, you know, why didn't the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality impose some control system or some safety mechanisms, knowing that the source of the water is a problematic source in terms of pollution, but also after it became clear that the water was not okay in Flint. Why didn't state agencies act? Why didn't the governor act? And so that's a part of this idea that, you know, we tolerate treating some people like this, and in particular under circumstances in which we're forced to make trade-offs.
Sheila, you know, you could argue that the people who were so mistreated had nothing to say about it. It's not exactly a democratic situation in Flint, Michigan. Don't they have a city manager that's been appointed, not elected? Responsible to the citizens of Flint, Michigan. He was appointed, wasn't he, by the governor?
Right, and I think one of the reasons why this decision was made at the state level is because of that political situation, that the state really is in charge, right, of the city. When the decision is made at a higher level, then democratic accountability at least can more directly occur, because in many cities or towns around the country, you're right, one could go right to their local officials and complain, right? There's a direct line of accountability, and here that couldn't happen, clearly because the state had, in a sense, taken over Flint, and this decision was made at the state level.
Sheila, are you aware of any other water-related cases like this going on in the United States?
Right now, I am not aware. That's not to say that it's not happening.
Would you say, Sheila, that this issue resonates at all with the Black Lives Matter movement?
Absolutely. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement is really a movement focused on the way in which there's a lack of dignity and respect for Black lives. And the situation in Flint is one manifestation of that. The idea that Black bodies, right, don't matter as much, the idea that the state and state actors, like the police here, like the agencies, like the governor, more cavalierly approach and treat the health and safety of Black lives than they would other lives, in particular white and more affluent lives. And to me, that this has to be a part of what the Black Lives Matter movement cares about and really is trying to bring attention to.
What about the question of money? It seems to me that the powers that be have all the money they need when they think it's important. They can guarantee loans to Ukraine for the government they support there, $2 billion. They can send weapons over to Syria and so on and so on. What's your observation about that with respect to these impoverished people in Flint who can't even get a glass of clean water?
Right. So I think poverty plays a clear role here. But in terms of this phenomenon of environmental injustice, environmental racism, it really is the intersection of race and poverty. Because, and the studies bear this out, right? When we study or when we map out who's more exposed to more pollution than the average American, or who bears the disproportionate burden of living near or being exposed to pollution and other environmental hazards, not only is race a factor, but poverty is as well. But when we control for both of those, the studies have almost consistently shown that race is the more powerful factor. And that's, again, not to erase the influence of poverty that poor people in general, I think, in this country suffer disproportionately in comparison to wealthier people. But the point is, when you overlay race and when race intersects with poverty, then the disadvantage is even more and even clearer. And so coming back to Black lives, there has to be a recognition. Black bodies, Black lives, and the way in which Blackness in general is treated in society has this resonance that goes back way to slavery, right? And that not, sure, a lot has changed, but so much hasn't. And those that are least able to buy their way out of racial disadvantage, and I think if one is of a higher class and has more money, there are ways to better navigate the realities of race. But for those who cannot, then we see this exact scenario. I mean, it's a lot like the policing scenario, the idea that we give a lot less credence and we don't stop and think as hard when we make decisions about, in this case, who's exposed, right, to pollution, what the state does about it, how quickly we notice that these people are in trouble, or how quickly we do something about it. And so in that sense, yes, poverty plays a role, but when intersected with race, we get a particularly vulnerable population, and that's what we see here.
Sheila, I understand a class action lawsuit is alleging that the State Department of Environmental Quality failed to treat the water for corrosion, as is required by federal law. Do you think that lawsuits such as this will have an impact in the big picture of environmental racism?
Sure, I think it can. If a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit is brought and the remedy or the damages are high enough, I think it can send a very powerful signal to states in the future about the consequences of inaction. But one of the reasons we have a set of environmental laws and environmental agencies is the idea that we should regulate to prevent harm. Lawsuits only come into play after harm has been caused and we need to remedy it. The ideal situation is to prevent the harm. And so the purpose of this lawsuit, I would think, is to bring attention and prevent in the future state agencies from not doing the job that regulatory agencies, and in particular environmental agencies, should have done here, which is to have put systems in place to prevent the harm, even if it was inevitable that the water supply had to be shifted for whatever reason, and let's assume it was for good reasons, having nothing to do with intentional or unintentional bias. But even if that was inevitable, the question is, why weren't more safeguards put in place? The agencies know how to do this. The state agency, I think, has admitted, at least in the press, that it made a mistake in not acting, that there were things it could have done. And so the lawsuit is, again, so ideally we shouldn't have to bring lawsuits. The agency should do their job. So part of the movement for environmental justice is to get state agencies to act before something like this happens.
Sheila Foster, we're running out of time, but it's really been a pleasure to have you on. And we look forward to seeing how things continue to unfold in bringing justice to all of those people in Flint, Michigan.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Madness, we call it madness. It's plain to see that is what they mean to me. Madness, madness, I call it madness. Madness, 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 they call it madness. I'm about to explain that someone is using his brain. Madness, madness, they call it madness. Suffer. Oh no, I won't.